so am I still waiting, waiting a long time,
waiting for tonight.
Listen to Revue.
Tonight's Survivor Series will certainly be no tea party. However, much like our forefathers who participated in the Boston Tea Party, the Americans are speaking out.
Just as John Adams led the Bostonians in the Boston Tea Party, I have the privilege of leading my fellow All-Americans into the Survivor Series.
Paul Revere's words ring true today, one if by land, two if by sea.
Paul Revere made his midnight ride to give a warning. Tonight, foreign fanatics, I'm warning you, you're not going to survive.
Bunker Hill stands out in history as one of the most significant battles in the Revolutionary War.
As far as I'm concerned, it's Bunker Hill all over again. This will be a decisive victory for the All-Americans.
The Granary Burying Ground. Some of Boston's most famous patriots are buried along the Freedom Trail.
In the shadows of the Granary Burying Grounds, where John Hancock and Samuel Adams rest in peace, four new headstones have been prepared for the foreign fanatics.
The All-Americans tonight might well heed the words of John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Speaking for the All-Americans, we know what we can do for our country tonight. We will defeat the foreign fanatics.
Is it safe to look within and erase all that's been and all that's been between? Is it gone? Tell me what went wrong. 'Cause baby, I'm not that strong.
It's Review Away time. John Pollock here alongside Wei Ting. Wei, what's happening?
Not much. I am,
recovered from last week? Are you...
Oh.
You got all your faculties back? Or have you just been drinking it up all weekend like you're running for the mayor of Toronto?
No, I have not. I don't know. I'm just, maybe I just didn't get enough sleep last night.
What are you drinking?
I'm drinking a 2-year-old can of iced tea.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't matter how old a can of whatever is, right?
They do, carbonated. They do have best before dates on the bottom of the cans.
Aren't they like really lengthy periods of time though?
I would think so. I think it's fine. I eat a lot of expired food. And I'm okay.
You look fine.
Yeah.
I'm drinking a 10-minute old coffee from Starbucks. They are now into the Christmas mode. I love it.
Yeah, well, what does that entail? What are you having?
I'm having the blonde. They got the Christmas blend, which is the dark coffee, and then the holiday blend is the blonde one.
Does it actually taste different?
I don't know. I haven't even taken a sip yet. But
do it now.
One's dark, one's blonde.
Okay. Do it now. John's sipping his coffee.
Definitely tastes like Christmas.
Yeah?
Yeah. It's got a certain holiday tinge to it.
That is such bullshit.
It is. Yeah, no, it's not. It's not.
It's complete bullshit.
Half of these things with coffee, it's just mental. If I told you something, here's the Thanksgiving blend, you'd automatically, I think your senses would automatically connotate certain things you associate with Thanksgiving when you're drinking it, when it could very well be the fucking 4th of July blend they secretly are calling it in the back.
Yeah, I don't doubt that at all. If I did a coffee, like the Pepsi challenge, but with coffee, would you be able to tell what coffee was from where?
I actually, of places I go regularly, I think I could.
Really?
There's a distinct difference between Balzac's and Starbucks and Tim Hortons and, okay. I mean, those are my three
we
main go-tos.
We should try that one.
We should do this sometime. Maybe we'll do a, we'll bring back our video and we'll post a video of us doing a,
What video?
Remember when we used to do videos on YouTube?
Oh, the Ask Away.
We'd go to random places and drink coffee and we'd talk to people.
Yeah. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go to a Starbucks and ask just for a cup, and I'm going to take it to another place and get them to fill that.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go to that place and ask them for just an empty cup and then go back to Starbucks. I'm going to give it to you.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
That'd be a lot of fun.
It's going to be one of these.
You should have like a random one too, like Joe's Coffee from over a couple blocks over.
And one of them will just be like brown liquid.
Oh, well, that's not nice at all.
Warm brown liquid.
What kind of liquid?
I don't know. Be anything.
How are you doing, Wei?
Doing okay.
Are you aware we're going to have a guest on today's show?
I am.
We are going to be joined by Bruce Hart later on in the program.
I can't wait to talk to him.
Get ready for that one. We're going to chat with him about the Survivor Series, the reopening of the Hart Brothers Training School.
No?
Yeah, we are.
Oh, yeah, we are. Okay, I couldn't tell. You're nodding your head.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's what we're going to be discussing.
Oh, yeah, okay.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's cool.
So we're going to hear what Bruce, his recollections of this event that was 20 years ago.
Wow.
The 20th anniversary of Survivor Series 93.
It's a big anniversary.
Who cares about UFC this month? It's Survivor Series month.
Yep. Oh, so this would have been the same month that the UFC...
It is. This event was 12 days after the very first UFC event.
Wow.
It's pretty crazy.
Wow.
Amazing when you look at, you know, that first UFC event and this... was the WWF's presentation back in 1993.
Why? What do you mean?
No, it's kind of interesting. You look at the evolution of both kind of promotions over the course of 20 years, where they've gone, what's different.
Both are very different.
Oh, extremely different from what they looked like in 1993, as would, well, pretty much any company.
Yeah.
What's similar? I think Major League Baseball. Have they really changed that much? It's like, now we got the wild card.
With the presentation? The TV?
Look at these sports. Like, if you think of baseball or hockey or basketball in 1993, I think you get, like, WWF today and 1993, like, light years in difference to me.
But you're talking about, you know, like, when it comes to sports, they're, like, Major Leagues, baseball and hockey, they're a lot more traditional.
Well, they have, you know, decades behind them.
Yeah, it's not like they could change the color of the blue line into, like, a pink.
You could have a flashing puck, though.
Then they
did. If you entered into a deal with Fox.
Yeah, they did. But that didn't really take off. Like, people are very
imagine if the UFC had signed a deal with Fox in 1994. The same time the NHL came aboard on Fox. What would Fox have done to the UFC at the time?
What would be the techno?
Like maybe if you throw a kick, it would like light up and turn red.
A steel chair? Or maybe like if it's
holograms? Or
they would have a light up chair or like a light up.
I think they would have killed the promotion within a year.
Light up razor blade inside?
Yeah, maybe. They'd be mic'd, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what's new these days in sports. I mean, you launch like a football game, and they have the graphics imprinted, but you can't see them in real life. But on camera, you can see them.
Oh yeah,
or like the lines.
Yeah,
like sometimes I think that's amazing. That's new. You know?
Yeah. Lines. I don't watch any football, so I know what you're talking about though.
Yeah.
Do you watch football ever?
No, I don't even know how to play.
No. Do you watch the Super Bowl every year?
Not really. No. We should actually review an XFL one of these days.
We could.
I mean, I'm just trying to think what wrestling related football product is there.
Oh, of course. There was a whole league.
When is that anniversary?
They started February 2001. So maybe in February we'll review an XFL game.
Okay, done. Remind us.
I watched that first ever XFL game.
So did I.
It was like a Saturday night. It's like my cousin's birthday or something, and we were in their basement, and I was like, can we put the XFL game on? And everyone there wanted to watch.
There was a lot of hype.
Oh, there was tons of hype for that first game with the XFL. They got a ton of promotion, whether it be positive or negative, of people who didn't understand what this was going to be. Vince McMahon doing football. And that first weekend, their first like primetime game on NBC did a monstrous number.
I would almost rather review one of the, because JR didn't do that first show, but I'd almost rather review one of the
he
ones
was
JR.
Doing one that same night, I believe, over on UPN.
Oh, okay.
He was doing one, but the big national game was the one on NBC.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we should review one with Jim Ross. Maybe we can get him on the show.
Sure, if he wants to talk about that.
We've got to talk about football.
Yeah.
Jim Ross, he could tell us what's a steamboat outside of wrestling.
Is that an actual thing?
Yeah, it's like when you have the ball and you're counting.
That's
like
one steamboat.
I'm trying to remember from when I played football in fourth grade with my friends.
Wow. Our American listeners must be like shaking their heads.
Yeah. Oh, we're gonna get a schooling.
It's
by
like hearing it's
NFL
like,
nuts.
Yeah, it's like hearing like somebody outside of Canada talk about hockey.
Yeah, though I don't think I would raise much of a debate if some American was talking about hockey.
No.
Yeah. Be like, yep, that's probably how things work in hockey.
Yeah.
The Survivor Series.
Yep. Well, what a segue.
I assume you were watching at home on
Thanksgiving Eve. I don't think I was watching this one. But I did. My family did get an illegal box not long after this.
Oh, maybe it was because of All Americans, and your dad maybe became a big Lex Luger fan. He's like, we gotta get a black box.
No, we're actually foreign fanatics.
Oh, dad. You?
Yeah, we're immigrants.
I guess that would have been the more natural. I guess segue.
Yeah, we're foreign fanatics.
The foreign fanatics.
Yep.
Why would they name themselves the Foreign Fanatics? That sounds like a name that was they were labeled by the promotion.
I would
object to that. Like it'd be like Wei, the irrational Asian. That's your nickname. I don't think you would accept
nicknames
that.
Nicknames are usually given to people though.
But team names, you would think they came up with, like the All Americans.
Okay.
Boring name, but I'm sure that team, I can believe that these characters came up with that team name. The Foreign Fanatics.
I believe that they would come up with that.
Today, what would they be labeled terrorists.
Foreign
fanatics?
So. I guess they would be more like freedom fighters if they were to name themselves.
Right. They could have been that.
Yeah.
So we had foreign fanatics consisting of American Yokozuna, American Crush, Canadian Jacques Rougeau, and legitimate
Finnish?
Overseas foreigner, the Finnish Tony Holm, Ludwig Borga.
Yeah. But the only, I mean, at least Yokozuna was built from Japan. Crush was actually built from Hawaii.
Yeah, he was the turncoat.
Oh, okay.
That was his gimmick at the time. He was no longer Kona Crush. He was Crush with a horrible mullet and paint.
Yeah, he cheered for Pearl Harbor.
I don't think any one guy has had so many gimmicks with the exact same name. Like, at least Brutus Beefcake, he always changed his name with the gimmick. But there was Demolition Crush, there was Kona Hawaii Crush, there was this Crush, there was Jailbird Crush.
Yeah, four Crushes.
A lot of Crushes before he finally had to say, like, all right, now I'm Bryan Adams.
Yeah.
And then we got Bryan Adams NWO, we had Bryan Adams Babyface in WCW, and then we had Chronic Bryan Adams.
Summer of 69, Bryan Adams.
We had Venturing Out of Wrestling into Boxing Bryan Adams.
Oh, wow.
Man.
Crush is a cool name. Why get rid of that? It's hard to change gimmicks, but it's even harder to change a name.
It can be very tough. Val Venus never was able to
get
past the name.
Mm-hmm.
Very difficult. Did you watch the countdown show for the Survivor Series?
I watched, like, I wanted to be a trooper, and I was like, oh, John's probably going to want to talk about this. So I watched 3 minutes, and I was like, okay, fuck this. No.
It was hosted by Todd Pettengill, who promised a night of family entertainment while he was in the stands.
Okay.
Boy, take my money. 3 hours of family entertainment coming up.
Yeah.
Let's get ready. And he promises a main event that will be talked about, quote, for years to come.
That's kind of true.
I guess we're making it accurate 20 years later.
Yeah.
Because I don't know how much discussion the All-Americans Foreign Fanatics match has gotten all these years. And then a match involving the four doinks that Todd Pettengill puts his credibility on the table, stating will be a classic. Not true 20 years later. Not true the night of in Boston.
Depends how you define classic.
Something good.
Not necessarily.
Well, I don't know about that. This was in Boston, Massachusetts. The WWF's first pay-per-view in Boston, actually, at the old Boston Garden. And what's interesting is that this year's Survivor Series will also be in Boston at the TD Garden.
Perfect.
Which was where the first UFC on FS1 show was this past August.
It's just no more MMA references, okay? Oh. Stop trying to brainwash me.
Oh, get ready for Ludwig Borga in the main event. Oh, talk lots of MMA.
Please. It's a pro wrestling show.
They showed a bunch of highlights leading up to this, throughout this countdown show. Lex Luger confronting Ludwig Borga on Raw after he was embarrassed by Ludwig Borga because Ludwig Borga compared him to a garbage truck driver. And Lex Luger, the All-American, fighting for the common man, was outraged that he would be compared to such a low-level job.
What would Duke Drosy have thought?
Duke Drosy clearly would have been at odds here with Lex Luger. And Luger said, here in America, we have an old saying, love it or leave it.
Mm-hmm.
Live by our way of life or get the fuck out of here. That's what this main event was built upon. They showed the Steiners losing the... they lost the tag titles by disqualification to the Rougeau brothers, the Quebecers, they were known as.
Is that happen usually? Do they change hands on it?
No, I think the Steiners didn't want to do a job, and they had to get the titles off of them. I think the Steiners, their contracts were coming due shortly after this event, and therefore, I guess they were playing hardball with dropping their tag titles to the Quebecers. I loved the Quebecers back when they were a team.
Yeah.
When they first came in, loved their theme music. I was always a big fan of Jacques Rougeau, mm-hmm. and here he was with Pierre-Carl Ouellette.
And Johnny Polo.
Yeah, and a young Scott Levy as their mouthpiece. As well, one of the most memorable angles of 1993, Tatanka's undefeated streak ends at the hands of Ludwig Borga, who hits him with a chair from behind and then pins him with one finger. I remember this match as clear as day. Watching this countdown show, I've probably not seen this in 20 years, and I remember so vividly watching on a Saturday on Superstars, Ludwig Borga pinning Tatanka.
Me too. I was quite sad, actually, because Tatanka was, you know, he was Goldberg. He had this undefeated streak for such a long time. And then all of a sudden to see him completely laid out and this guy pinning him with one finger.
And then takes the bonsai drop.
Yeah.
And he's removed from the match, and they replaced him with The Undertaker, where Luger, he gives this speech for the reveal of The Undertaker, where he talks as if Tatanka is dead. He says, Tatanka, he is with us in spirit. And he's here in spirit with us right now. But we have to move on. And then they bring out the dead man. The actual dead man in this segment.
Yeah.
Then Luger took out Pierre Ouellette, and they replaced him with Crush on the team. And
why did they... He got taken out.
Yeah. I think they just... it was kind of an eye for an eye.
Yeah.
And then another replacement on all of this... This was interesting because they had this thing called WWF Radio at the time, Radio WWF, that was pretty much available to all the people in the armed forces, and they did commentary for a couple of pay-per-views. So they had Jack Tunney call in. Jim Ross was hosting it to announce that Jerry Lawler would not be at the Survivor Series because of these alleged charges that he said were horrible accusations being thrown at Jerry Lawler. He will not be there, and Shawn Michaels will replace him on this show.
What was that?
A woman at the time had accused Jerry Lawler of, essentially, of statutory rape.
Mm-hmm.
And these were, like, heavy charges, and they took Lawler off TV, and then the woman completely changed her story and essentially said that she was lying to, I guess, just get some attention.
And Tony made mention of it?
Made mention of it. Didn't specifically state the charges, but that they were really horrible charges.
On this family-friendly program?
On, Radio WWF, they were going to cut a little deeper. And so Shawn Michaels, who had legitimately been suspended at the time, was brought back. And during his absence, they had put the Intercontinental title on Razor Ramon.
Oh, that's why they called him the Three Knights.
The Three Knights?
Yeah, Shawn Michaels and the Three Knights.
Yeah, it was supposed to be Jerry Lawler's Knights on this show. And all I can say about Jack Tunney, this man was so incredibly dull. Just the blandest delivery.
I mean, but totally believable in his role.
I guess so.
He's not a performer. He's somebody who you could actually believe as the, I don't know, head of a company.
They cut back then to just this random crowd shot in the lobby of the Boston Garden, and you just hear Todd Pettengill yelling, I'm over here! Everybody wave at my cameraman! And then suddenly in the background, we see Todd Pettengill wave his arm. The cameraman had lost him as they cut to him live. But they found Todd, thankfully.
Oh, he loves to have fun.
And we would just finish off with Pettengill with Vince McMahon, and Vince just says, Todd, are you having fun? And they show Gorilla Monsoon and Jim Ross, who were doing Radio WWF for the broadcast. Todd is just killing time. He starts singing. And then they did a backstage skit where Bobby Heenan, they were playing up this big grudge between Bobby Heenan and Gorilla Monsoon, where Monsoon wanted to get his hands on Bobby Heenan. And this was leading up to Bobby Heenan's exit from the company just a couple weeks later. So that was the countdown show.
Okay.
I was stoked. I was ready for this.
Oh, man, I'm sorry.
This three-hour Survivor Series pay-per-view.
Sorry I missed it.
The announcers for the show are Vince McMahon and Bobby Heenan. They plug the fact that the Boston Garden sold out in less than an hour and teasing the problems between Heenan and Monsoon. I've got to say, I would have rather had the option of Radio WWF. I would have rather heard Jim Ross call this show than Vince and Heenan.
No, me too.
I would have preferred Ross and Heenan would have been my ideal pairing for this show.
Yeah.
Vince McMahon, are you a fan of Vince's commentary?
Well, listening back these days, there's a certain charm about his style. And he does have a knack for it, I will say. Like, you know, he has the voice, he has the delivery, and obviously nobody would know the storylines better than him, the guy who's writing it. But he would never be able to call a move, any maneuver.
They showed this match on the countdown show. I always know, like, Vince always had this thing of, like, trying to get some close finish over by, like, it's over, it's over, he's won, he's a new champion. No, he kicked out. And the most ridiculous example of this was Yokozuna defending the WWF title against Bret Hart on this USA Network special. And Bret has the sharpshooter on Yokozuna, mm-hmm. and the referee is distracted or he's out, and Vince starts yelling, He's given up! I just heard Yokozuna quit! We have a new WWF champion, and it's Bret Hart! And they show Owen Hart, he's coming down the aisle, they're like shaking hands with all the fans to celebrate the win, and then out of nowhere, like, Fuji hits Bret with the bucket, the bucket of salt, and then Bret's knocked over, and Vince is like, No! Yokozuna's out! But it was like 25 seconds of Vince, like, calling it as if, like, this was the post-match celebration that Bret's won. And it was just always so ridiculous that he would just, like, get so far ahead of himself for a fucking kickout.
Yeah.
Or a near submission.
He should learn to observe, think about what to say, and then say it.
Yeah, he was just, 100 miles an hour kind of announcer.
Yeah.
It's just crazy. I was never a big Vince McMahon fan.
He was the voice of that era.
He had a great voice.
Yeah.
It was just the substance at times could be a little jarring.
Mm-hmm.
So we start things off with a traditional Survivor Series match. We've got the heel team of Diesel, IRS, Adam Bomb, and Rick Martel. Diesel had recently debuted that prior spring, and they were taking on the team of the 1-2-3 Kid, the Intercontinental Champion Razor Ramon, Marty Jannetty, and they were supposed to have Mr. Perfect as the fourth man on their team, but he was unavailable for this show. I don't know what the issue was. If it was, I think he was having some issue with the company because he was, I think it was a contract issue at the time because it was at this point in the fall that he disappeared. He worked the SummerSlam show, and then I believe he was told that he was going to get the Intercontinental title when Michaels left, and instead they went with Razor Ramon, and I think this created some issue between them. And then he'd return at WrestleMania 10 as the referee, and they kicked off that feud with him and Lex Luger. And then again, Perfect didn't sign with them, and he disappeared again for a bunch of time, and then he'd come back as an announcer. So it's kind of this weird period where it was like they were teasing stuff, and then he'd take off.
And a real waste of, some prime years of his career.
Absolutely. And then again in 96, he was all ready for his comeback, and he was going to be paired with Triple H, and again, just took off at that point, and then he would end up in WCW in 97. So it was like this really weird time period from when he kind of retired as an active performer after that SummerSlam show with Bret Hart, and then he made the comeback in 93, and then by this point here, by the fall of 93, he was already kind of on the outs again with the mm-hmm. company. So anyway, their replacement at the last minute was Randy Savage, who's essentially just a commentator at this point in time, but they were building up a feud with him and Crush. And one thing I got from this whole show, Way, was that, man, you could see the direction for, like, the whole, like, half of the WrestleMania 10 card you saw laid out here. Savage and Crush, you saw them moving towards an eventual unification with Razor Ramon and Shawn Michaels. They were teasing quite a lot at this time. Bret and Owen.
Could you see that? Oh, yeah, you're right, yeah.
Well, you had Razor had the title, and Shawn was saying, I'm the real champion. Well, I mean, you could see where they were going.
I mean, they were only two pay-per-views away from WrestleMania.
Yeah, but it's just, imagine right now having, you know, your top-end card of WrestleMania kind of laid out on television. I mean, there's tons of different directions they could still go.
A lot less shows.
Yeah. Harvey Whippleman was the referee of Adam Bomb at this time. Adam Bomb, guy who represented an actual, like, nuclear explosion.
Yeah. He should have been on the All-American team.
Yeah, one of their greatest creations. Mm-hmm. When he first came in as this gimmick, his name was Atom Bomb, but they spelled it A-T-O-M, Bomb. Ooh, okay. And I guess they thought, that's too lame.
That's too goofy.
And then, he'll be Atom Bomb, A-D-A-M. He's a human being.
Yeah, way more believable.
Yeah, maybe Atom was trademarked by somebody. Probably not.
I don't know.
IRS cuts a promo saying that the crowd is lucky that their team isn't coming to audit them.
Ooh. What about IRS?
IRS.
Erwin Arshite.
You know, of all the wrestlers out there who it's like are broke now or have been tragedies, thank God Mike Rotundo was not one of them. Like, talk about, you could look back at this guy, the guy who was the law-abiding taxpayer. Had he turned out to be a wrestling tragedy who was left with no money.
Right.
It would have been such a weird look back at this character.
Would have been ironic.
I think it would have been. If IRS declared bankruptcy, absolutely it would have been.
IOU
would have been his new gimmick.
Ah. Yeah. Wow, there you go.
Or garnish. If you garnish someone's wages.
Okay.
That means that when you get a paycheck, the government gets a percentage of them because you're in debt.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's interesting.
Then Razor Ramon gets on the mic saying that Mr. Perfect tagged out, and he has a replacement in Randy Savage, who comes out to a very good pop. This match, Way, interesting for one fact. All eight of these guys would at one point wind up in WCW after this.
Well, that's cool.
And four of them in the New World Order. Can you name which four?
Diesel.
Yep.
Six.
Yep.
Nash. Or sorry, Hall.
Oh, man, five of them actually would.
Okay, Hall, Savage, and... You got
Nash, Hall, Savage, and Waltman. And who's the fifth? The fifth is kind of tough.
You're telling me, well, who's remaining?
You've got Marty Jannetty.
IRS?
Yes, it's IRS. Michael Wall Street.
Oh, shit. Yeah. He wasn't... Oh,
one of the lesser members of the NWO. VK Wall Street.
Okay.
So, the match begins. Ramon starts off with Martel, who he had beaten in...
I think half the guys on this show ended up being members of the NWO.
There was a lot of it. This was the early 90s WWF, and guys were looking for those big deals elsewhere, and a lot of them would wind up with them. I mean, hell, Marty Jannetty ended up in WCW, working like Saturday night and... You know, someone to lose on that second hour of Nitro. So, with Ramon and Martel, they had the backstory where they had... it was a battle royal on Raw, and the final two would have a match for the vacant Intercontinental title, so it came down to Ramon and Martel. Bomb tagged in.
The Bomb family.
What the fuck happened to Brian Clark? You never hear anything about this man.
He probably just got out of the industry.
I guess so. Just kept quiet. He was overpowering Ramon, and it built up to a spot where he suplexed Bomb. And then Martel got upset here and decked Harvey Whippleman. And this pissed off Adam Bomb, because apparently Bomb had a short fuse. And the heel team starts fighting with one another, and they were teasing an implosion.
Oh, man.
Diesel then starts beating down on the 1-2-3 Kid. They... made a hot tag to Savage. Crowd was nuts for Savage during this match. They loved to see this guy. And this was at a time when Vince really felt he was done as a full-time performer. But man, you watch this match, crowd loved this guy. Yeah. And you clearly had more years left in this guy.
Well, I think he was probably the biggest star out of that, you know, 80s, late 80s era that was still around.
Oh, yeah, with Hogan gone at this point, Savage was, you know, a big deal to a lot of people. Atom Bomb then ran into Diesel. Savage hit a knee to Atom Bomb, sending him to the floor, and then hit a top rope elbow drop to eliminate Diesel. There was a great interplay here when Bobby Heenan asked if Vince has ever cheated someone. And Vince was just silent and then said, no. And Heenan says, you should try it sometime. It's fun to swerve someone.
Oh, okay. What do you think he was? Vince was nervous about?
I don't know. This was right before the steroid trial in 94, so he might have been a little worried about what he would say there.
I thought he meant like marital cheating.
Oh, well, it could have been that too. Yeah. Who knows? The heels had the advantage on Razor in their corner. Savage comes back in and climbs to the top when Crush comes out, and Savage runs after Crush. The team is trying to stop Savage. Savage gets on the ropes and then gets rolled up by IRS by the distraction of Crush. And Savage just runs backstage, and we got a Coliseum Home Video exclusive where we saw Savage in the back.
Was this an exclusive?
I think so. I don't think this would have aired live. And it was just Savage going into the bathroom, couldn't find Crush, gave up.
And for some reason decides to kick over trash cans.
Well, he's upset.
All right.
He's been eliminated.
Yeah, but it's not Crush who's going to clean that up.
Ramon then runs IRS into the corners, hits a short little choke slam, and then the Razor's Edge to eliminate IRS. Then everyone's brawling into the ring. There's a Razor's Edge to Martel, but IRS then hits Razor with the briefcase. But before he can hit it, Ramon goes to the floor and he's counted out. And it comes down to the 1-2-3 Kid and Marty Jannetty with Atom Bomb and IRS. And this is where the match, I thought, really picked up. Kid and Jannetty were a great tag team together. There was a flying clothesline into the ring by Atom Bomb. And Martel was also in the match at this point. They're beating down the 1-2-3 Kid. He tags in Jannetty. He fires up on Martel. Kid hits a sunset flip out of the corner to pin Martel. And then Jannetty hits a sunset flip to pin Atom Bomb immediately afterwards. And they get the pin. And the win here. So Jannetty and 1-2-3 Kid are your sole survivors. 26 minutes and 1 second.
Yeah, a lot of time.
Lengthy matches we got with these elimination-style matches.
Yep, I really enjoyed that finishing sequence. And it was interesting to see who they left in the final four here. Especially.
Yeah, it wasn't the focused performers.
No, it wasn't.
Like Ramon, Savage, and I would say, to a lesser extent, Diesel and IRS. Because they were building up to Ramon and IRS for the Royal Rumble.
Yeah, I believe, you know, they just wanted to leave the other ones for future storylines. But I thought 1-2-3 Kid and Marty Jannetty did a great job as the high flyers of the group. So
a long match, but a good final couple of minutes. And the Savage stuff the crowd was really into. Todd Pettengill is with Shawn Michaels in the back, who's wearing his Intercontinental title. And they throw to Ray Combs, the former host of Family Feud, interviewing the Hart family, including Stu. And pretty much all the Harts take turns speaking and making puns about Harts.
Huh.
Including, we had Brett, Owen, Bruce, and Keith with Stu in the corner. Then they go back to Shawn Michaels, who starts insulting the family. This was such an awkward program because it was all built up on Jerry Lawler and Bret Hart and Lawler insulting the Harts constantly. And now Shawn Michaels was just brought back, and they pretty much wanted him to play the role of Jerry Lawler, who suddenly has a problem with the Hart family now, and that it's been this big feud that's been brewing since last year's Survivor Series where Bret and Michaels were in the main event.
Watching it in hindsight, it feels so natural because they've always had that rivalry, and they did have the feud with the Harts later on with Shawn.
But, sure.
But, yeah, at this point, there's probably something that felt kind of out of place. But he did a great job of it.
Yeah. Having him in this match certainly helped things a lot. They went to Jannetty and the 1-2-3 Kid, who went back to the locker room to celebrate with Razor Ramon. And Razor says it's okay that his teeth were loosened and says, we don't come to jive. We come to survive. I don't know what that means.
It's weird to hear him talk like a Cuban now, knowing that he's nothing like that.
No. But, this was really when they were really getting behind him as he had just turned babyface.
I thought he was a great anti-hero for the time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he came in as the heel, and then it was at this point they decided to flip him over and caught on very well as a babyface. Ray Combs is in the ring, and he introduces Martha and Georgia Hart. Then he introduces Keith and Wayne Hart.
Ooh.
Oops.
Big mistake.
Poor Ross.
Yeah.
Poor Ross Hart.
Come on.
I mean, Keith is in the match. He's in the back right now, and Ross has to get up and wave as if he's Keith Hart. This poor guy, Ross Hart, I mean, got no love on the Hart Anthology DVD. They cut so much of his stuff out. I don't think he even got a chapter on himself in that DVD, if I'm not mistaken.
Did they all get chapters?
I think almost all of them got chapters.
I don't think so.
We'd have to go back and watch it.
I don't see there being a chapter on... I'm sorry, some of the lesser known Hart brothers.
The thing is, though, Ross is like an encyclopedia. He's great for that kind of stuff because he remembers all these dates and.
Right. I don't know, maybe they just didn't find enough clips of him. Maybe they thought he was Keith and, like, yo, we already have Keith.
They were so confused.
Yeah.
Ross and Keith are two different people.
Yeah.
So he introduces them, and then Helen Hart is introduced, gets a big reaction. And then we've got to go into Ray Combs' stand up routine. Where he says how Shawn Michaels was asked for three states with the word new in them. And he said, Nebraska. Crickets, except for one Vince McMahon who thought this was so funny. Then Ray Combs said that when Shawn Michaels' mother goes looking for Bigfoot, Bigfoot takes pictures of Shawn Michaels' mother. Whew. And it takes Shawn Michaels' father 2 hours to watch 60 Minutes. These are all jokes, mind you, that Jerry Lawler would recycle for years afterwards. They must have had the same joke book.
Yeah, probably.
Like, this was just horrendously bad.
It was definitely lame.
Ray Combs had a very sad end.
Mm-hmm.
Like, killed himself afterwards. He was like, went into rehab and...
I gotta say, watching this show, you know, this whole show was kind of sad.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I was not gonna say what you thought
I was like, what's Way gonna say?
No.
There was a lot of casualties on the show.
Ludwig Borga, you know, killed himself too.
Yes, he did.
A lot of tragedies.
The next match was our Family Feud match, where we had Shawn Michaels and the Knights. The Blue Knight, the Black Knight, and the Red Knight, represented by Greg the Hammer Valentine, Barry Horowitz, and some ultimate classic wrestling represented here by Jeff Gaylord.
Whoa.
From the dying days of World Class. And the last question, Steve, is up here in Canada on the Fight Network, we air a lot of your old stuff from World Class in the late 80s. And my one question to you is, whatever happened to Jeff Gaylord?
You know what? I don't know. I had a conversation with someone several years about Jeff Gaylord, and I thought that guy was going to have a lot of potential, great body. Wasn't the sharpest knife in the drawer, but, man, I had a lot of tag matches with Jeff Gaylord, and to me, he was a good guy. I don't know what happened to him.
Amazing.
Yes. I have written so many intros for Jeff Gaylord.
No, is that right?
And
they never revealed themselves. They just kept them in the hood.
No. And
nor should they have. I mean,
no, I disagree.
What?
These were like three just faceless jobbers to people, and the result was the crowd didn't care about this. As it was, they barely, I think, were familiar with Bruce and Keith Hart. Mm-hmm. You essentially had three people that the audience was familiar with here, and one of the Knights was supposed to be Terry Funk, who the night before just left the note for Vince McMahon that my horse is sick.
What do you mean? Like, Funk
Funk was going to be one of these Knights.
Yeah, and was he supposed to unmask afterwards?
I don't think so.
He was just going to play a generic
Yeah,
guy?
Like, I mean, the roster was so thin at this point that you essentially just needed bodies to fill out this team. But to me, I mean, they were just banking on this was going to be Brett and Jerry Lawler were the heat for this match.
Yeah.
And you would tell the story with Owen by the end. But man, for this match of people that the crowd just didn't know who they were and didn't care, I mean, they went... How long did they go in this match? This was 31 minutes!
This was the longest match on the show.
Holy Christ. Stu was seated in the corner here with his Bruins jacket on, and the Harts got the advantage early on Shawn, with Bruce and Keith in, and they were trying to play up how Keith has not wrestled since 1989. And I was like, holy Christ, he hasn't wrestled since 89. And then I'm thinking, wait a minute, that was 4 years before this. It wasn't that long ago in hindsight. We had Ray Combs on commentary for this lengthy match.
I actually thought he did a good job for celebrity.
He wasn't horrible, but he wasn't needed either.
He was just your celebrity. But I thought for a celeb, he was very knowledgeable, seemed like a genuine fan, and actually did a good job of putting over this babyface team.
They got the heat on Bruce in their corner, and there was this big clothesline off the ropes to Shawn Michaels, and then Brett would come in, getting a bunch of near falls on the Black Knight. And then Owen came off the top with a missile dropkick and pinned the Black Knight. So there goes Jeff Gaylord after 10 minutes and 49 seconds. And they're already playing it up on commentary here with Bobby Heenan giving the idea that Owen is in the shadow of Brett and Vince just pretty much writing it off as you're being ridiculous, Bobby. But a good foreshadowing for what was the whole point of this match was essentially to get that story across for WrestleMania. The Hearts are working over the Red Knight. There was a figure four by Keith. Michaels made the save, but then Brett eliminated the Red Knight, Barry Horowitz, with the sharpshooter at 18 minutes. And then Brett gets knocked to the floor. He's selling the knee as Michaels works over him. There's a jumping reverse elbow by Michaels. Owen gets tagged in, and Combs here just going for all the one-liners. Michaels slides to the floor, and he goes in front of Stu, and Stu just decks him with a shot that Michaels sells massively. I mean, this was the biggest pop of the whole match, I thought, was Stu decking Shawn Michaels. So they built up well to that spot. Bruce and Owen then clothesline Michaels to the floor, and Owen has the sharpshooter on the Blue Knight, who submits. So it's now 4-on-1, all the babyfaces against Shawn Michaels.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if whoever laid this match out was the same person who laid out Brett and Vince, where it was like 25 hearts on one Vince McMahon at WrestleMania 26. It was the same psychology here.
Yep. You definitely start to feel a bit of sympathy for Shawn, the heel, with four guys that he has to fight.
And a father.
Yeah.
Just decked him. Mm-hmm. There was a huge belly-to-belly by Owen. Owen and Michaels, I always thought, just had such incredible chemistry together. There was an In Your House event in 96 where these two had like a 20-minute main event, and it's fantastic. There was a reverse Irish whip by Michaels, and Owen then runs into Brett, who is selling on the apron and walking across. So Owen knocks into him, allowing Michaels to roll up Owen, and Owen gets eliminated. The only Hart brother who would be eliminated in this whole match. Brett comes back in with Michaels, crotches him on the ropes, and then Bruce goes after him. Michaels then runs to the back and gets counted out at the 31-minute mark. So the Hearts, Bruce, Keith, and Brett are your survivors with Owen the sole elimination. They're celebrating the win. Owen comes back out, and he gets right into Brett's face. He rips him down from the turnbuckle. He's all upset. Yells that he doesn't get any recognition, and Combs calls this a real family feud, and the crowd is booing Owen, and Owen refuses to speak to Todd Pettengill as if he was King Mo talking to Frank Shamrock.
Good match.
I just thought the crowd was not into this, and
I thought it was good. I thought the match itself, but I thought the finish was kind of lame. But overall, I thought they did a great job building to the Owen story here with Owen just, the moment that he got pinned, just hit it on a switch. He goes from, the supportive brother to being the upset, whiny brother. And I thought that was handled really well. I thought it was really cool to see all four Hart brothers wrestle because they all kind of have their own style. Keith was much more of the methodical, rest hold type of guy, where Bruce I found to be quite quite fast paced and just a real ball of energy every time he was in the ring. And Owen, of course, with a lot of lucha. So I thought that was really cool just to see all four Hart brothers.
They almost like played down Bruce and Keith. They almost like tried to push like one's a fireman, one's a school teacher.
Well, that was the heel. That was Heenan saying all that.
But Ray Combs was pushing it a lot, too, the fact that these are, okay. And not even healing on them, just saying right. That these guys are kind of almost out of their element here.
No, sure, because they're not full-timers, whereas the other two were. And I thought Helen did a fantastic job of looking upset at the end in the crowd.
Oh, this was nothing, though, compared to her performance the next year.
No, but it was certainly still better
than... She brings out the best. She was the one heart that really thrived in the Survivor Series setting.
Yeah, and so, but definitely better than, you know, whatever they're trying to get out of the Miz's parents.
Well,
I really think...
She's the blueprint.
Yeah, I'm not even kidding. I thought she was tremendous as somebody just looking concerned. Now, of course, knowing full well that it was all a work.
What match did you want to see more after this? Bret and Owen or Michaels and Stu?
Bret and Owen or Michaels and Stu?
I kind of would have loved to have seen Stu have one last match with a guy like Michaels.
Yeah.
See if he could still have a great... I bet you they'd still have a fucking great match.
Stu didn't even look like he could really stand up for most of this. He was just sitting down for most of it, so I don't know.
They throw to Jim Ross and Gorilla Monsoon, who are going to call the next match, and they're going to switch spots with Vince and Heenan going to do the radio portion, and Ross and Monsoon coming to do TV. And the crowd pops here as Monsoon teases hitting Bobby Heenan.
Mm-hmm.
They were really into this between these two. They announce WrestleMania 10 from Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, it was so interesting.
It was such a... like, uneventful announcement. It was just, like, this random video and...
Well, they didn't really have any matches or anything. It was just a logo. I liked it. But it was interesting to see, like, a preview for an event in the future that's already happened many years ago in the past.
Yeah, almost 20 years ago.
Yeah.
We're getting ready for WrestleMania 30.
Yeah, I know. So that was kind of sort of a trip.
Jim Ross throws to a video package on tonight's main event featuring the Foreign Fanatics. And that leads to Jim Cornette coming out, because before he manages Yokozuna in the main event, he has his team, the Heavenly Bodies, challenging the Rock and Roll Express 10 years before their epic TNA match.
10 years before they joined Sex.
They were defending the SMW tag title, Smoky Mountain Wrestling.
Yeah, what is the deal with this?
This was a time when they brought in Jim Cornette, who was running Smoky Mountain Wrestling, and the depth issues were such that they started a working relationship here, and for the SummerSlam card right before this, and for Survivor Series, and I think that they had some Smoky Mountain talent in the Rumble a couple of months after, they gave him a pay-per-view slot. I mean, the roster in 93 was extremely thin.
Wait, but nothing on... Did these guys have TV time on Raw?
They made the occasional appearance and stuff like that. I didn't. This to me was the best match on the show, so I was not complaining.
This was a good match, but nobody knew who the fuck these guys were.
No, that was a big issue. Was no one knew who these guys were, and despite what they did in the ring,
it's just so unusual for Vince to give any type of his TV time to people not that.
Oh, this was very bizarre.
Much less pay-per-view time. You're telling me, you know, you couldn't find two guys on the undercard who. Or two guys who usually have on Raw who weren't having matches to put in. Not that I'm complaining. This was a good match, but the crowd didn't seem to care.
Well, I mean, look at what followed this. We had, like, Bastion Booger and the Bushwhackers. I mean, they didn't have a whole ton of options. You know, to fill 15 minutes on pay-per-view, why not? So Ross identifies Smoky Mountain Wrestling as a regional company, and the Heavenly Bodies go to the floor early on, and Morton hits a suicide dive to both. Gibson then with a flying head scissors to the Gigolo, Jimmy Del Rey.
Yeah, he really creeped me out.
The Gigolo.
Yeah.
I'm a fan of Jimmy Del Rey. No relation to Lana.
Who?
Lana Del Rey.
Who the fuck is that?
You don't know her? That song Video Games. She has a whole bunch of songs.
I don't know. Oh, okay. No, I don't.
Ross notes that this began with Jim Cornette managing the Midnight Express a decade ago, and that's how Cornette and the Rock and Roll Express has been feuding all these years. Maybe the only time that the Midnight Express was uttered on a WWF pay-per-view before they had Bodacious Bob and Bombastic Bart, the new Midnight Express, failed recreation.
Bodacious Bart.
Bodacious Bart. Awesome. And Bombastic. The Bodies are regrouping on the floor. Pritchard then comes back in with a powerbomb to Ricky Morton. Del Rey then hits an acai moonsault. Like, they were going crazy here, and this crowd didn't give a shit.
Yeah, I didn't expect that acai moonsault, but yeah, these guys are definitely working hard.
You underestimated the Gigolo.
I did. Clearly, everybody had a lot of chemistry between the four of these guys.
But this was a style that I think was foreign to a lot of these fans. I mean, these were WWF fans that, yep. I mean, Christ, a cross body was a big spot at this time. After the acai moonsault, Gibson makes a save in the ring. Morton hits a double DDT.
The reaction for that hot tag was just nil.
No, they were just, I mean, and much like the Knights, I think, like, they responded to characters they were familiar with and spots that they were, you know, taught to pop for. There's an O'Connor roll by Morton, but he gets tossed over the top, and they explain that in Smoky Mountain Wrestling, that would be an automatic disqualification. But in the WWF, they don't adhere by that rule.
The commentators explain that. The people in this audience had no clue what the hell just happened.
So Cornette then gets knocked off the apron by Morton, and Gibson has the cover, but Del Rey then comes off the top of the tennis racket and knocks out Gibson, puts Tom Pritchard on top, and the Heavenly Bodies win the Smoky Mountain Wrestling tag titles at 13 minutes and 42 seconds. I know the crowd sucked for this, but I enjoyed this match.
Yeah, very good match, but just the wrong audience to do it in front of.
Speaking of a match that I don't think any audience would have welcomed.
Well, we go back to Vincent Heenan, by the way.
What did they do here?
Just take over on commentary.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right, thanks for the break, Gorilla.
Yeah, thanks.
And JR.
So Vince back here for his forte to call Bam Bam Bigelow, Bastion Booger, the former Mike Shaw, and the Head Shrinkers taking on Men on a Mission and the Bushwhackers, wearing Doink face paint. Mm-hmm. And I think this was at the time they were switching between Matt Bourne to Ray Apollo, because Matt Bourne was trouble on the road when it came to handling some issues, and they were about to... That's one of the things. When you're under under face paint like that, you are very easily replaceable.
True.
And that's what happened there with Ray Apollo taking over the gimmick. And in the meantime, Mabel, Mo, Luke, and Butch took over for... as the Four Doinks. And Bastion Booger, of all the names in wrestling way, that one's maybe at the bottom. This Bastion man was so Booger. Effective that, you know, like back, I remember this so clearly, because this never happened. They built him up with these vignettes, and it was like any guy. You do vignette, he's coming. Shows up, and his first match on Superstars, he gets beat by Virgil. And it was the first time I remember me and my friend Mike, in like third grade, we're like, did you see Bastion Booger debut on Saturday? It's like, yeah, he lost. What a loser this guy is. Huh. And it was like instantly labeled, like I immediately just looked at this guy as a flop. He lost to Virgil in his debut match. And then they did a rematch the next week where he beat him. But nothing. That to me was the perfect indication of an impressionable 8-year-old John Pollock. First impressions, you don't get a second stab at it.
No. I don't know how far they thought they were going to go with
Ashton. Oh, WrestleMania main event here.
Oh,
with,
yeah?
The Booger era.
Yeah, I guess so. Booger versus Taker, WrestleMania.
Oh, yeah, imagine that.
Yeah.
He would have been a prime candidate for The Undertaker to feud with.
Why is that?
Big fat guy with some weird gimmick.
Right.
That was The Undertaker's forte.
Could have sat on Taker's face.
Yeah, that would have been a little...
That's his move.
Yeah, that was his finish.
Yeah.
He would stand over a guy and start doing this dance, and it was called the, I can't remember what the name of the hold was.
I don't know what it was called either, but we're not talking like a bonsai drop.
No. He would fall on his knees, and it's like he would like teabag the guy.
Exactly. Yeah, it was just like straight out of a porno.
Bastion Booger.
Like taint to nose.
Yeah. Luke started biting his ass. And then stomped his foot. They tagged in Samu, who got sprayed in the face with water, and Butch pinned him at 3 minutes.
What? No, Samu. They were handing Samu balloons, and Samu, being a Samoan, would bite into these balloons.
Of course.
Didn't know though that a subsequent balloon was filled with water, which caused him to lose this match, which was a first, I imagine, lost by biting into a water balloon.
Yeah, probably a first and maybe a last.
Yep.
Booger then did his finish, sitting down on Luke, but then gets off of him at the count of two because he sees a banana. And he comes to eat the banana, and Luke gets pulled away. Booger takes the battering ram, and then Mabel pins Booger.
Pinfall by banana, another first?
Yep. That was still to come, actually. Bigelow then took Moe's scooter and destroyed it. Like, Bigelow was like the only serious character in this match. He felt so out of place.
There was a scooter here inside the ring.
The guy with the flame tattoo on his head was like the serious character. Fatu nearly loses Mo, going for the side suplex, and then hits a splash off the top to Mo, but then Fatu gets mesmerized by this banana as well, this elusive banana. Butch comes in with a bucket of water, which is empty. He goes to throw it. Fatu takes the bump anyway, as they explain he slipped on a banana peel, to which Butch pins Fatu. A slip on a banana peel finish. It was actually the literal finish here. Mabel is then in with Bigelow. Mabel misses a splash in the corner. Butch gets sent this garbage in a bucket that he pours onto Luna. They all splash Bigelow in the corner and pile on top of him. And the four doinks pin Bigelow 10 minutes and 58 seconds. This is near the bottom of the list of pro wrestling matches I've ever seen.
Well, I applaud anybody who, you know, I think comedy can add a lot to a card to kind of, you know.
Was this comedy?
That's what they're attempting. But this was just not good. This was just not funny and a bit of a real mess.
Literally. Literally a mess.
Yeah. Yeah.
Doink shows up on the screen as Bigelow and Luna are leaving, and he's laughing at them. And he just cuts these horrendous jokes about, I was only clowning around. And all these other clown puns. And this was the setup way for Doink and Dink to take on Bam Bam and Luna at WrestleMania. They were thinking long term here with their undercard.
Oh, that's nice.
We were going to get 3 more months of build for 4 months of Bigelow Doink buildup. The Doinks are then celebrating in the locker room, and they sing Whoop, There It Is together in unison. Much like you and me sometimes sing after a great show.
Yeah, we sing Whoop, There It Is.
Yes.
Watching Luke and Butch sing Whoop, There It Is kind of made this all worth it.
Then we go to Todd Pettengill in the back with the Foreign Fanatics. 4 men, 3 managers.
Yeah.
There was no shortage of talkers here. Well, actually, Mr. Fuji was just kind of there for... he was like an ornament.
No, he manages. He probably fills out the paperwork.
He just sat there. Yokozuna had 2 managers.
Yeah.
He had his spokesperson and his whatever Fuji was.
Yeah.
The man who carried his flag.
Yeah.
So Cornette cuts a promo on their team being winners, who will do anything to win and will carve up 4 turkeys on Thanksgiving. And he goes to break down each one, isolating the heart as the Steiners, the mind being the Undertaker, and the soul being Lex Luger. And what will happen when you take out each one of those individual elements? I thought this promo was fantastic.
It was good.
Jim Cornette, I don't even doubt that this man probably gave like 10 minutes of thought before this promo. This was just great.
We haven't denigrated anybody. We're upholding a fine American tradition. Be winners at any cost, and that's exactly what we are. We're winners, and we do anything to win. And thirdly, there's a fine old American tradition, carving up a turkey on Thanksgiving Eve, and that's what we're going to do. We're going to carve up 4 of them. Now, everybody's been asking, everybody's been wondering since this match was announced, what is your strategy? How are you going to fight the All-Americans? Going to divide and conquer? You're going to mount a frontal assault, an all-out attack? Well, let me just say this. We've sat down and we've thought about this. The All-Americans, we look at them like one man, because they fight together, they stand together, they think as one. They're a unit. So how do you take a man out? Well, you can go for the mind, you can go for the heart, or you can go for the soul. Now, the heart of the All-Americans is the Steiner brothers. They got a never-say-die attitude. They'll fight to the end. But you give a blow to the heart, it can be devastating. Now, the mind is the Undertaker's. Because after all, he's the master of fear, the master of psychology, the master of the psych-out. But if you take away a man's mind, he's confused, he's disoriented, and you can easily take him out. But then there's the soul. And the soul of the All-Americans is Lex Luger.
Team Captain Lex
Luger. Shut up,
Pettengill.
He's the embodiment of the American dream, the spirit to succeed, victory against the odds. Lex Luger is the soul of the All-Americans. And when you capture a man's soul, then you've defeated him once and for all. And tonight, that's going to be our strategy. Mind, heart, and soul. The All-Americans are going down in the Boston Garden tonight.
I was ready for this main event after the promo.
Mm.
Then we got a video on the All-Americans where they were all compared to different historical figures in U.S. history. Lex Luger compared himself to those that led the Boston Tea Party, and then each performer cut a promo about who they were representing, including Scott Steiner and his hair.
Best was Undertaker, who's, I don't know what he said, but it's like...
It was so forced.
It was like these guys were given a homework assignment. Relate yourself to a historic American event. And then here you have The Undertaker cutting a promo about how he is somehow related to John Hancock. I don't know, some shit out of a history textbook.
The heels make their entrance. They note that Yokozuna was on Conan O'Brien the night before.
Oh, wow.
Which I would have paid to have seen.
Yeah, I hope that's still around. There's a sign in the crowd that says, USA, love it or leave it, you foreign freaks. I'm not sure if they'd allow that one today.
How polite. So we have Yokozuna, Ludwig Borga, Jacques Rougeau, and Crush taking on Lex Luger, The Undertaker, and the Steiner Brothers. There was a stare down between Yokozuna and The Undertaker to start, and that seemed to be the big program they were pushing here. It was like the ultimate goal was Lex Luger challenging Yokozuna again for the title, but the immediate build-up was to get your interest in Taker challenging Yokozuna, because that's where they were going to go for the Royal Rumble in January. And the crowd is chanting USA, and as much as the crowd was out of it for a lot of this show, they were really into this match, and the Americans trying to triumph here over the foreigners. Rick is trying to get Yokozuna off his feet, finally sends him to the floor, and then Rick comes off the top and knocks Ludwig Borga down, but then Rick comes off the turnbuckle, is turned by Borga in midair, and Borga eliminates Rick Steiner first at the five-minute mark.
Finish was a little botched.
The finish was botched
during
that sequence. Scott is then in with Crush, hits this double underhook suplex, and McMahon announces that Randy Savage is back in the building. And with that, he comes out as officials are trying to hold him back, including Billy Red Lions making a cameo here. And Savage, he's taken to the back, then he comes out again, and Scott drop kicks Crush to the floor. He goes after Savage, and they start fighting in the aisle, and this leads to Crush being counted out at 11:35. Jacques then hits a pile driver to Scott for a two count. Luger gets tagged into a huge pop and just hits his little axe handle off the second turnbuckle to eliminate Jacques. Mm. It's just like a nothing move.
Well, because of his elbow.
Oh, right. He does have the loaded forearm, which I always thought was like such a heel characteristic that he took over when he turned babyface. It's like, here, this guy's got a metal plate in his arm.
No, he can't help it.
Steiner delivers a superplex to Ludwig Borga that the announcers are just stunned by what that was. And Yoko makes the save, misses a backsplash to Steiner, recovers, hits a leg drop for a pin, so Scott is out. And then Borga goes after the ribs of Luger. Yoko comes in, misses a splash in the corner, and Yoko tags in Taker, who comes into a big, big reaction. Taker is attacking Yokozuna, knocks Borga off the apron, hits a belly-to-belly. He takes one by Yokozuna, and Taker just sits right back up, takes a leg drop, and then gets dragged over. Yoko goes for the bonsai drop, and in mid-air, Taker rises up. If this was timed poorly, Taker would have broken his neck here. He's like rising as this giant ass is coming down on him.
He's really good at doing that. It takes some incredible ab strength.
And Taker is then taken to the floor. He no-sells these step shots, and Yokozuna and The Undertaker are counted out. So we're down to Luger and Borga. Borga's beating down on Luger, constantly going for pinfall attempts. Luger hits a vertical suplex. They have a double clothesline spot. And then Cornette distracts the referee. Fuji passes the bucket to Borga, who clocks Luger with it. But the pin attempt is stopped, and Luger rolls on top, kicks out, hits a DDT, a back elbow, a power slam, and then hits his flying loaded forearm to Borga, and Luger triumphs at 27 minutes, 58 seconds. Confetti comes out of the ceiling. Santa Claus comes out.
It was snow, actually.
Oh, it was snow.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I misidentified. And Santa Claus and Lex Luger go off the broadcast celebrating together.
The snow and Santa was a bit much. I mean, come on.
It wasn't even Thanksgiving yet.
Yeah.
It was the eve of Thanksgiving.
It's a bit much.
Yeah.
But it was the only pay-per-view I guess they had before Christmas. Yeah, the match was okay.
I thought this pay-per-view was... I'm not even going to say... I thought it was a little underneath okay.
I didn't think it was a good show, really. I like seeing the Hart brothers in action, just as a novelty. And I thought that Owen angle was set up really well. I can't really say that there was much else worth watching here.
It's like this was at a time when you didn't have a lot of great workers in the company, and the great workers that were on this show were kind of hidden in these multiple-person matches where you really couldn't showcase that.
Yeah.
And you had lengthy matches that were... for the most part, rather uninspiring throughout. So I didn't think this was a great show. I gave it a 4 out of 10, and that's mainly for storyline advancement, setting stuff up for the future, and a really good tag match, I thought, in the middle of things, and a lackluster Boston crowd.
I give it a 3.
A 3. All right, well, that was our thoughts on Survivor Series. Now we're going to go on over to Calgary, Alberta, and we're going to chat with Bruce Hart. See what he has to say about this show, and maybe he can give us some behind-the-scenes thoughts on the setup for this match, what was initially planned for Bruce, and more on the 93 Survivor Series.
Shit, I think I forgot my passport.
Oh, dear. We don't need a passport to get to Calgary, though.
My Chinese passport.
Oh, right. They will flag you.
I'm a foreign fanatic.
Are you saying that... the All-Canadian is going to have to... This is going to be an All-Canadian interview, I guess.
I guess so.
Wow. Okay, well, we'll see you in a little bit.
Okay.
First of all, when did this whole idea come together? Because you do outline it in your book, which is available now, Straight from the Heart, through ECW Press, that they brought you down at SummerSlam that year. So when did the whole ball get rolling where it would lead to this match with you teaming with your brothers, Brett, Owen, and Keith?
Yeah, it was a little exasperating in retrospect. You know, the whole thing always sounds hard to believe when you really... I remember it was like a Friday afternoon in August, and I just happened to swing by my dad's place, and my dad told me that Pat Patterson had called and said... there was some tickets for me to fly to Detroit the next morning for SummerSlam, and I told my dad and I knew nothing about it, and I it's like totally out of the blue. And anyway, I got a hold of Pat, and he says, "Do you want to fly down to come down to SummerSlam tomorrow?" And I'd already been through more than a few, kind of wasted initiatives with Vinny Mac and Pat and all them, and I sort of said, quite frankly, and I don't have a great desire to fly all the way to Detroit just for to watch the matches. Is there some money involved or whatever? And he sounded like he was a little taken aback that I wasn't doing cartwheels, about being invited down to SummerSlam or something. And so, anyway, to make a long story short, he sort of tersely said I'd be getting paid. But anyway, I flew down there the next day, and I think one of the main events at SummerSlam that year was supposed to be Brett against Jerry Lawler, who was sort of playing on
right.
The king of the... He was at his height as... semi-legit villain at the time, and anyway, they told me they wanted me to be planted in the crowd and playing some kind of a quasi-mark or something like that, and then just before the match, they changed the thing to where Jerry was feigning an injury and was now going to be replaced by Matt Bourne. Doink the Clown or something like that.
Yep.
And so anyway, from there, I was supposed to, I think at the end, they were supposed to gang Brett and beat him with the crutches and all this other nonsense. And then I was supposed to hit the ring and, go ballistic on Jerry and Matt Bourne. And so I did it all in it's pretty simple, and got a surprisingly decent pop, and that was supposed to sort of set in motion this storyline for Survivor Series. I guess it was supposed to be a couple of months hence, which was, they called it the Family Feud type thing. I think if only because they had this guy named Ray Coombs who was the host of Family Feud. And it, so it was originally supposed to be me and Brett and Owen, who was in WWE already at the time, and my brother Keith, who had wrestled out here quite a bit but not done much in WWE. And I think originally you were supposed to fight Lawler and Doink, and then I think they had initially planned Terry Funk and Shawn Michaels. And then anyway, we flew down there, and before I left Detroit for SummerSlam, Vinny and Pat Patterson told me they had some really hot angle for me that I was gonna really love it, but they couldn't fill me in because they were still working on it or something like that. And anyway, a couple of months later, I flew down for this Survivor Series gig, which by this time I think Lawler had gotten into some trouble with the law in Louisville, and Doink had been fired for drugs or alcohol or something, and I think Terry Funk quit.
Yeah, he just left the note the night before and just walked out, apparently, as legend.
Yeah, he actually left. I saw him the night before they summoned us to the restaurant in Boston. I was kind of amused, not to digress, but in Calgary, we went to inordinate lengths. You never ever see the heels and the faces and, company with each other in a restaurant the night before. here we are in Boston for the Survivor Series, and they have a summit, and we're sitting in this big, restaurant with Terry Funk and Shawn Michaels and all the other guys, I think Pat Patterson and company are running the finish by us, and I sort of discerned that Terry wasn't too thrilled with it. I think it basically was entailed Brett. I think Owen was supposed to be eliminated first, and then Brett was both a sharpshooter in succession. Terry and Greg Valentine, who is now replacing Lawler, and I think Barry Horowitz, and
right.
All of them, and Terry, I discerned he wasn't too thrilled with the whole thing. All I know is he left his. They had, adding insult to injury, they had them all wrestling with masks on, so it didn't even matter anyway. Like there's. He wanted Terry Funk, who was a big name, but now he's supposed to be wearing a red mask called the Red Knight, and Sean was supposed to be the White Knight, and Valentine was the Black Knight or some asinine thing like that, which added to the... But anyway, Terry left his Red Knight mask and get up on my... left it hanging in a laundry bag on my hotel room and, with this cryptic note, tell Vince I had to fly home, my horse was sick or something like that.
Wow. That was the story that I'd always heard. I never knew if it was true or not about my horse being sick.
And then I wasn't too thrilled with the whole thing. I was kind of wondering myself because they had, Vince and Pat had told me they had something really mega involved, and when they ran the finish by me, it was like, it doesn't sound too mega to me, and I've been around the business long enough to know the difference between, something meaningful and, essentially just tagging along for the ride, and I found out after, somewhat to my chagrin, that launched this storyline between Owen and Brett, where Owen became kind of like the spoiled sort of jealous, you know, brother or whatever, and they kind of turned on into a heel around that time. But I guess they originally wanted me to turn into the Blackheart, you know. We had actually had a tag team in here called the Blackhearts, I might add, with that Gangrel and a guy named Tom Nash. But anyway, they wanted me to, I guess, turn heel on Bret and then become sort of like this embittered, you know, kind of devious a-hole type, you know, which would have been fine. It would have been a good, the money would have been good if nothing else, you know, but I found out that Bret had vetoed the whole thing. I have no idea why, but that was sort of the outline of that whole thing. But yeah, it was a little frustrating. And
It seemed that, like, on the surface, Bruce, I mean, this thing had just so many issues. I mean, the big program was Bret and Lawler. Lawler's out of the mix. You've got these three guys under masks that the crowd really has no reason to react to. It's just
there's no family connection. Yeah,
exactly. It's like suddenly Shawn's inserted in Jerry's role. And I think that, you know, for the WWF as well, it's not like they positioned you and Keith going into this match to kind of really have a lot of momentum either. It just seemed like it was just so many X factors to have to deal with here. On top of that, you know, getting this across in a 30-minute match.
Oh yeah, it was somewhat of an insight into the and quite often you see that all the time. Almost every time I've been down there, there's all this kind of you have this perception of this really mega organization and all this other, and it was kind of like flying by the seat of your pants type stuff all the time, you know. And, I know a few years later, I think I discoursed briefly on it in my book, but I know Pillman called me up when they're doing that Canadian Stampede, the big pay-per-view in Calgary with
right.
Supposed to be the Hart Foundation, who were playing they were sort of hardcore heels at the time in the WWE, but in Canada they were sort of almost kind of anti-heroes, you know, like they're pro-Canada, and they were you know, kind of kicking ass on Steve Austin and Legion of Doom and all those guys. But anyway, Pillman called me up for this. This was in 97, I guess, and he told me they had some hot storyline in mind. That he kind of called me up and cued me in and said they were, at that time, I think the Hart Foundation had every belt but the Intercontinental or something like that. But anyway, I was supposed to be sitting in ringside and at some point do some kind of interference with Owen and Steve Austin, and that was supposed to enable the Hearts to win. And then the next day I was supposed to go up to Edmonton where they were shooting Monday Night Raw and you know, kind of launch some kind of angle. I think it was supposed to be on Jerry Lawler's King and His Court type thing, which they were doing up there, and Stu and I were supposed to be being cross-examined by Lawler, who was still sort of a heel then, and then Steve Austin, who was at his peak then as kind of like the American badass redneck. He was supposed to come out and you know, accost me for having cost him the match the day before, and we were supposed to have some kind of a brawl or a pull apart, and then that was supposed to lead to some kind of a showdown with me and him at SummerSlam on Montance, you know. And so we did the thing in Calgary and it got a mega pop, you know. It was like a 10-minute standing ovation and the crowd was going nuts. And I remember after the match all these all the Hart kiddies, like the nephews and the nieces and the grandchildren. And
oh, yeah, it was a very memorable scene.
And So I thought it was pretty cool, you know, like the crowd was, you know, going ballistic for a good 10 minutes, standing ovation. And so the next day, drove up to Edmonton to do the thing with Lawler and the King and his court and all like that. And I remember Stu and I, they wouldn't even let us in the back door. And I couldn't figure it was like, is this some kind of a rib or whatever? And so Stu and I ended up just turning around and going back to Calgary. And I was told later that Bresser vetoed the whole thing because he was choked because all the kids and whatever had come in the ring, and he thought that maybe I had invited them in the ring, which I had. They just all climbed in because the crowd was eating it up, and so Brett was choked about that, and so he vetoed the whole thing. And I found out from Pillman, Pillman told me that Brett had kind of nixed the whole thing, and it was kind of a little pretty frustrating. I might add that was the last time I ever saw Pillman alive when he told me that. You know, he passed away about...
It would have been just a few months after, October 97.
About 8 weeks later, you know, in Minnesota. So it was kind of... But yeah, it was kind of a... That's sort of frustrating. It was another insight into the ways and means of... wonderful world of fantasy, as Barry Orton used to call it, you know. So.
Now, just going back to the Survivor Series, were you aware at that point that they were going in the direction of Brett against Owen coming out of the Survivor Series? Was that
no,
pretty much...
I found out later that Brett had... I actually found out about it, sadly enough...
in his column, right?
About a year after Owen died, Brett was writing a... in the newspaper column, and he divulged that WWE had, you know, this big storyline in mind where they wanted me to play the, you know, kind of turn heel on Brett, and that was going to lead to, you know, this family feud type thing with me and Brett. And Brett divulged in the paper that... he had adamantly, you know, kind of ordered Vince to go with Owen instead. And frustrating part for me, John, was that Owen was already in the WWE, and he's already pretty established and making pretty good, you know, coin. He'd been there for a couple of years, and he was, you know, not... he's in a pretty good position and all like that anyway, but so, yeah, it was a little exasperating. You know, at that time I was having some pretty serious financial trouble with, I just had a, son who was, you know, born premature and, was in the hospital for about 9 months with, cerebral palsy or whatever, you know, so it was a fair bit of stuff and a left fair bit of expense at the time. And it was pretty demoralizing to have the rug pulled out and not even, and then find out later on that it was not Vinnie Mac and them who had actually done it. Initially I thought there's, you know, frivolous BSers or something like that, and I found out after it was kind of much to my chagrin, Brett, you know, which is a bit tough to take, you know.
Did you and Brett ever discuss it afterwards?
No, he never did, you know, and I don't like to even digress into what looks like kind of, you know, family friction or whatever.
Right.
But nonetheless, it was kind of frustrating, the whole thing, you know.
And coming out of that show at the Survivor Series, I mean, maybe expectations going in versus what came out of it. Because I know later in 94, they did bring you on the road for a bit. How do you look back at how the match played out and just, you know...
Yeah, I think I briefly alluded to that in my book, too. But I did the tour. It was funny, not to digress again, but I remember they flew me down to L.A. and we were supposed to start this so-called heart attack tour, and it was supposed to be Brett and me against Owen, and they had brought Jim Neidhart back as a heel, and we were supposed to have this be headlining shows all over the country with the hearts fighting each other, you know, and I think we started in San Diego, and we were supposed to work our way up to, like, L.A. and Oakland and Phoenix and Denver and all the way back to the East Coast. So it was supposed to be, like, close to a month tour, you know. And, but I remember the first night we went out, and there wasn't there was maybe about 5,000 people in the building down in San Diego where the Clippers used to play, and it was like about an 18,000 seat, you know, it's about a quarter full, and most of the wrestlers were having the same match, you know, the same match they had in San Diego, they had the next night in L.A., and the next night in Oakland, and so anyway, I was kind of trying to spice things up a little. Like in Stampede, we always used to change the matches, you know, never have the same match that we have in Edmonton that we had in Calgary. But they're having the same match every night, so I'm sort of deviating, just mostly ad-libbing and actually getting pretty good reactions. And I remember finally, after about the eighth night of this tour in Denver, you know, we were getting pretty good pops out of the crowd, just kind of doing this improvised stuff rather than, like, they were big on all these, you know, giving you almost like a manual or a written script, and you do this and he does that, and which was, you know, if I had ever done that in Stampede, you know, guys would have told me shove that, you know, I told Diane my kid or Bad News Allen or Stomper, you know, I've drawn up a little, you know, script for you here. It's 40 pages of stickman diagrams and all this nonsense, you know. But that was sort of what they were doing down there, you know. They had all this, you know, you do this first and he does that, and I was sort of deviating from it and getting a pretty good reaction. And Owen and Neidhart were fine with it. They were, that's all we ever did in Stampede, you know. You never had any, in Stampede, all you usually did was give the guys a finish and maybe give them a rough kind of outline of why you wanted what you wanted. And that was about it. But anyway, to make a long story short, after the match in Denver, which was probably our hottest match to date, I came out and this one of the bookers, a guy named Jack Lanza, called me out, and he starts giving me some big undressing in front of all the wrestlers about how come you're deviating from the script, and you know, the wrestler, you're an effing school teacher. If that was some kind of something to be embarrassed, or, you know, like a criminal or something like that. And he kept going on and on, and you you shouldn't be doing anything in the ring except exactly what this, and you're, you know. At first I thought he was ribbing, you know, because I figured he knew it, you know. He should have known that I had been wrestling for 15 years or more at that time anyway, you know. So I was going along with it, waiting for it to be revealed to be a rib or something like that. And but he kept going on and on. And whenever I was a booker, I would have called guys. If I had something to say to somebody, I'd call them aside and speak to them one-on-one, not in front of the whole dressing room and all like that. And so I finally started firing back, and I said, "Hey, Jack, if I'm not a fucking wrestler, why the hell did you bring me down for Survivor Series, and why the hell did you, why do you have us in headlining this whole tour?" And it's a bit like that movie Trains, Planes, and Automobiles, where Steve Martin's unloading on the car rental woman or whatever. But why the fuck did you, and blah blah blah. And he didn't have any answers for me, and he's kind of speechless that I called him out and slammed the door and said I don't have to answer to a fucking school teacher, as if that was some low form of humanity or something like that. But yeah, I was told later on that Brett basically lit a fire under Jack and said he didn't want he wasn't thrilled with me and on, and Neidhart deviating from the script or whatever. But as I think, as you and I were discussing before, I think that's one of the, for me, that's one of the problems with WWE even these days now, is way too much scripting and not enough improvisation. In the old days, the great workers, all they ever usually had was a finish and not much more, and they would improvisationally weave these kind of classic matches. They'd go 60 minutes or 90 minutes, and they'd be, and very little of it was scripted or choreographed. It was always just sort of playing it by ear, as they used to call it, just sort of unfold. And
right.
There's not enough of that now, and unfortunately most of the so-called wrestlers in there these days, I think they almost panic if they don't have the training wheels of the script, kind of hold everything together, But I'd like to see a lot more just, playing it by ear and doing things, kind of taking it whichever way they sense the crowd wants it to go, But
what was Shawn Michaels like to deal with at this point in time?
I thought Shawn was great.
Yeah.
He seemed like a pretty good guy. There was some kind of, apparent heat between he and Brett, but I think they've resolved it, hopefully.
Yeah, it seems so.
But he was actually great. He reminded me of, some of the guys, the types of guys that we had in Stampede, like Dynamite and some of them. He was took great bumps, understood the sell and the comeback scenario, and he was sort of playing a heel a bit at that time. And oddly enough, he had just come back from suspension or something, so he wasn't really,
yeah,
and we had no pre-existing issues at the time. But yeah, he was actually one of the best, and I worked on occasion with other WWE guys, but yeah, he was one of the better workers I've ever worked with down there. He would have fit in well with the guys like Dynamite and some of them, that he seemed to have a similar style, and he seemed like a pretty consummate professional, Sean. I never had any problem with him at all. It's unfortunate whatever transpired a few years later in Montreal. That was kind of awkward, and I never really, even at that time, I never really held any of that against Sean. Sort of like The Office maybe put him in a bit of an awkward position, but I told that to Brett at the time. Wasn't, you can't really be holding too much against Sean for that. It was, The Office. I sort of alluded to a bit in my dissertation in my book on that, you know. But yeah, I actually thought Sean was, you know, great. And I worked later with his, you know, ex-partner, Marty Jannetty, and he was a pretty good worker, too. You know, he sort of got the short end of the stick somehow or other. I'm not sure what transpired. He had a few issues, I guess, but both of them pretty consummate professionals, I thought.
John Pollock back here with the Foreign Fanatic.
Yeah, well,
pretty interesting interview you missed out on, didn't you?
I know. Really good chat, though. I mean, I could hear it all the way from here.
Well, that's good to know. Well, we hope you enjoyed that interview. Thank you to Bruce Hart for coming on the program. For the full interview with Bruce, we chatted for about an hour. I'm going to put the full interview up on Thursday. That was just the portion relating to Survivor Series. But if you want to hear more, including some thoughts on the current product, about some other stories going on right now, his assessment of the recent Daniel Bryan push, lots of stuff with Bruce Hart and the Hart Brothers University, that is going to be up Thursday morning at liveaudiowrestling.com. And I want to thank Bruce for coming on. You can get more information at facebook.com/HartBrosUniversity, Hart, B-R-O-S, University, and on Twitter at Hart_BROS_U. And now we're going to get into your feedback, our other featured guest, you, the people. And you can always leave your feedback up at lawradio.proboards.com on the law message board. Also, a lot of fun activity always going on the message board.
Yeah.
Whether it's correcting our mistakes, whether it's chatting about just weight and stuff he does in general.
It's always talk about that.
Oh, there's hidden threads that you can't access.
Hidden threads?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Wow.
I don't want to get into it. Let's start off with Hacksaw Jim Powers. Speaking of the message board, the man behind the fact-checking thread.
Yeah.
Writes, hey gang, and a special welcome home to the most factual man in pro wrestling, John Pollock. I think he's saying that tongue-in-cheek. This is one of my favorite pay-per-views, and it was a multiple rental of mine from the local video flicks in suburban Ottawa. And it's pretty much entirely because of Bobby the Brain Heenan. He seemed to work well with everybody when he started doing more commentary during the latter half of his WWF run, and Vince was no exception. Heenan's work during the Hearts Knights matches may have been his very best. There's even a compilation of his commentary during that match on YouTube, simply titled Bobby Heenan is God. As for the actual matches, the lack of attractive storylines during this period was on full display, and combined with the dreadful Survivor Series format, thank the good Lord above for the Brain. 4 out of 10 for the show, 10 out of 10 for the Weasel. And he also mentions that it was during this week that The Sign by Ace of Base came out to tie
Whoa.
In. Were you a fan of the Survivor Series traditional matches? I was never really into them myself.
You know, I love the idea of them, and when they stopped doing them, I thought it was odd, and I was kind of hoping that they would bring them back. But watching a show like this, a lot of these matches just ended up kind of being meaningless. But I do love them when they have a theme to them, like the Hart Brothers versus, I mean, you know, Sean being there didn't really make sense. But if it was Lawler versus the Harts, I think that's great. The rest of them, they just end up kind of being long matches. I think they're at their best when you do have a theme, when it makes sense to have the four people team up, and also when they can build sub-storylines out of it, like they did with Owen and Brett in that match.
Survivor Series was always great to really, you know, kick off stuff for WrestleMania. Like, it was usually around Survivor Series time that you really got your idea of the big plans for WrestleMania. And to a degree, that even exists today. Like, I mean, as much as we talk about WWE and they'll change month to month, they might change directions, WrestleMania is pretty well, they have down and know the direction they're going in, and it's around that time that, you know, Survivor Series used to always be a great kind of setup to get everything rolling, and the Rumble is when you're really hammering stuff home of what direction you're going in.
So I think there's still a lot of potential for that, and I wish, you know, just for nostalgia and just to keep up with the tradition, that they would at least have one or two Survivor Series style matches per pay-per-view. And also, at this point, you have so many pay-per-views that just seem the same, you know. At least have one or two of them that kind of stand out with a match type, and I think they should at least do that.
And one other thing, this was Bobby Heenan's last show with the last pay-per-view with the company before he would go to WCW, and they'd write him off about 2 weeks later with Gorilla Monsoon throwing him out of the building at Raw. And Heenan, this would be his last WWE pay-per-view till WrestleMania 17,
right,
when he did the gimmick Battle Royal.
Hmm. We go to Aram, who says, I remember when I was 8 and I watched this show on Scramble Vision. It was great, and I loved the matches. I saw it today And it sucked. What the fuck? I still love the Brett Owen angle, but what the hell? I did, however, always enjoy the tag team names. I really don't understand why there can't be one pay-per-view a year nowadays where they do have a card filled with 4-on-4 matches. It doesn't draw money or what? I think that would be part of it.
Yep.
I did, however, get to see my childhood favorites like Men on a Mission and Bastion Booger. I was hoping for a Bastion Booger, Bam Bam Bigelow, and Luna to reenact the Hogan Savage storyline. Bastion Booger was the biggest heel at the time. He stole kids' ice cream bars. 2 Booger bombs out of 10.
Let's move on over to Ronaldo from Milan, Italy. Well, on one side, it's nice of you guys to review an old-school Survivor Series show, where you know they actually had Survivor Series matches, but on the other hand, up until 1996, they were all pretty much the same. The formula was to take a bunch of guys with hot feuds, put them together in teams, and you have a pay-per-view. Nice concept, but in 93, it was pretty much done, in my opinion. I do remember watching the Heavenly Bodies Rock and Roll Express, and while I knew who Morton and Gibson were, I wondered who those guys with beer bellies were, and how good that match was compared to some of the crap we were getting back in the day. Oh yeah, the start of the Hart family feud, and to be honest with you, I do respect Bruce Hart's seniority in the business, but this was Owen's time to shine. I bet if Vince had any real intention of pushing Bruce, those horrid tights erased any chance of him getting a more prominent role other than the usual family member at ringside. Sorry, Bruce, rest of the card was okay, considering the era and my age at the time of being 13.
It really is hard to picture anybody but Owen in that spot, because Owen just seemed to play it so well. And, you know, I thought Owen was probably, aside from Brett, the more seasoned and the more, well, not necessarily seasoned, but the one who looked the best in that match, too. So, I don't know. We go to Mike from Caledon, who says, I watched the show when I bought part 1 and 2 of the Survivor Series anthology back in 09. The only thing I remember about the show is the fact I didn't want to watch it again. I give this show 2 out of 10.
Next up, we go to Jason from Florida. I very much remember renting this VHS from Blockbuster the first second I saw it. I'm a big fan of the Survivor Series elimination matches, but this particular event left a lot to be desired. A few things I remember are Savage being a sub for Mr. Perfect, which is fine. That match with Jannetty, Ramon, Kid, and Martel was the best match on the show. I always found Marty Jannetty to be extremely underrated. Lawler was originally supposed to be teaming with the Knights against the Harts after feuding with Brett for a year, but he got subbed out for Michaels because of rape allegations. The match was probably better with Michaels instead, but it didn't tell as good of a story as it could have. Also, kudos to Owen for planting that seed for what would be one of my favorite heel turns of all time and working it like a champ. Owen was certainly one of a kind. Heavenly Bodies and Rock and Roll Express, yawn. The four doinks were all terrible, and I feel bad that Bam Bam was stuck in that dead-end program. Main event was weak. Taker wasn't great yet. Luger is Luger. Ludwig Borga was never good. I'd prefer a tag match with just the Steiners and the Quebecers. Yoko was great with a good opponent. Luger is not that person. 5 out of 10 for the opener, and Owen being awesome.
We got a JB from Boston who actually attended the event for his very first pay-per-view when he was 9. When tickets were put on sale, it was a firestorm. You would think WWE was on fire at this time, as it clearly wasn't, but tickets sold out in record time. My father claimed to have went to the Garden and could not get them. Later, it was reported the event sold out in less than 30 minutes. Luckily, my dad got us balcony tickets via a second-hand ticket outlet for double the price. He says, the idea of three Hart brothers teaming with Brett felt and still feels awkward. In storyline, it made sense, but at the time, Owen was a jobber, and Bruce and Keith were unknown to casual fans or little kids like myself. However, the match had a good mystery leading regarding who Jerry Lawler's knights would be. Then Lawler was pulled and disappeared off TV as HBK returned to team with three guys in masks. The day of the pay-per-view event felt like Christmas. Before I knew it, I was on my section, and Todd Pettengill was kicking off the pre-show 4 rows down from me. Yes, I was marking out for Todd Pettengill. The SMW tag team titles were a glorified intermission at the event live. Nobody cared. I knew of the Rock and Roll Express from my WCW in 90 and 91, and had last seen Ricky turn on Robert to join the York Foundation. At 9 years old, I thought it was stupid Robert would be back with the guy that betrayed him a few years earlier, and to what the guy said earlier, the Heavenly Bodies were anything but heavenly. Their WWE run till this show was lackluster, boring, and they had already dropped out to the Steiner Brothers on pay-per-view.
Next up, Josh from Leningrad. I was confused at the fact that Hawaii was considered foreign. This show was pretty boring. I watched it on pay-per-view back when it was live and never watched it again until today, and I must say I never thought of it again until now. My crazy associative mind was more interesting than this show when I was realizing the Red Knight was Barry Horowitz, who was Jack Hart in Florida, who won the NWA Florida title over Mike Graham, who later committed suicide in a territory where the booker, Eddie Graham, had recently committed suicide, and the match had a guest commentator, Ray Combs, who also committed suicide and is one of two people on the show who committed suicide, with Ludwig Borga and a referee who had a famous suicide angle in Tim White. Fuck, this show is depressing. And so is your feedback, Josh.
Steve Sanders from Los Angeles. This is just a dreadful show and, in my opinion, the worst Survivor Series of all time. From September to December of 93, I ordered Fall Brawl, Battle Bowl, and Starrcade. Survivor Series, though? No way. This card is just embarrassing even by 93 standards. The big title match is from some regional, yokel, local promotion that runs in front of 100 fans inside an old barn. And the blown-up slugs taking up the main event, Luger, Borga, Yokozuna, and Taker, just terrible. Hand over that $30 to see three guys in masks do chin locks for 20 minutes. Bushwhackers going over, Ray Combs, this show is as wrestle crap as it gets.
All right, and that's going to wrap us up for this week's edition of Review Away. Thank you, everybody, for your feedback on the message board. And now we're going to get on out of here shortly, but next week, Way, you are on the clock. Top Survivor Series 1993. What do you have in store? What are you going to subject me and all of our listeners to over the next 7 days?
Okay, well, I don't know if it tops Survivor Series 93, but...
Oh, I don't know if that's really saying a whole lot.
Let's do a show that I think we've got a few requests for, and that would be WCW Mayhem, 1999.
Oh, man, a show I was at live.
There you go, a show that was in Toronto. This is WCW's November pay-per-view, one of only two Mayhems that they've ever done, the first. And this one features a World Heavyweight Championship tournament.
The infamous Vince Russo, Ed Ferrara booked WCW title tournament.
Featuring Bret Hart, Chris Benoit, Sting, and Jeff Jarrett.
All right. Well, that's going to come up next week as we go into the scary world of late 90s WCW.
Mm-hmm.
So, Wei Ting, a very brave man, as we will review Mayhem next week from the Air Canada Center, the first wrestling pay-per-view ever to take place. Actually, the first wrestling show to ever take place at the Air Canada Center was WCW Mayhem, and the first night I ever met Jason Agnew and Dan Lavransky.
No way.
November 21st, 1999.
And was this not the first WCW pay-per-view?
First WCW pay-per-view in Canada as well. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. A lot of firsts. You know what? It was not the first wrestling event. It was the night they ran Nitro there earlier that year, wasn't the first first pay per view though.
Yeah.
So there you go. We'll take a look at that next week. In the meantime, you can go to liveaudiowrestling.com. Subscribe to The Law Live Audio Wrestling on iTunes. You can follow each of us individually at Law Radio, at I Am John Pollock, or Wei Ting is at Wei, W-A-I, 0937. And I thought we could end this off, Wei. A great person turning, had a birthday this week. I don't know how old he turned. Do you want to share with us?
He's 30.
Is he 30?
Same age as
he's the same age as us. I didn't know if he was a few years older.
Yeah.
Well,
a big 3-0.
The big 3-0 for one Gordon.
Yep.
In fact, is it his birthday? It was his birthday on Monday, wasn't it?
Yes.
I feel we should have called him. Wish him a happy birthday.
There's still time.
I think...
Why don't we get back in our time machine?
Well, I think that,
Here.
I don't have a phone.
I do.
I think we should give him a call.
We should actually use my number.
Well, are you saying he wouldn't answer mine?
Probably not.
Oh, well, that's unfortunate.
Well, what would we say?
Oh, I think we should wish him a happy birthday. Oh, a belated happy birthday.
Okay. Do you want to talk?
Sure. It's been a while since we've heard from Gordon.
Let's hope he's not working.
He's always working. He was supposed to come watch Bellator on the weekend.
No, he wasn't.
It's Wei and John.
Hey, John, how are you?
We just want to wish you a happy birthday.
Thank you so very much, sir. I appreciate this.
You're on our podcast right now. Is all of our listeners want to wish you a happy birthday as well. Is there anything you'd like to share with them?
I just want to thank everybody. I'm I'm here with a customer now.
Dude, when are you going to take a day off? When are you going to take a day off?
Yeah, I haven't taken any day off for the last 3 weeks.
All right.
Stop bullshitting, man.
Mr. No Days Off. You're always with the customer.
Okay, Gordon, well, we're going to go out for some beers this weekend for your birthday, okay?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Oh my gosh, I turned 30. I'm old now. I hate it.
Yeah. All right. Well, tell your customer we said hello.
Easy.
ReviewAway.com.
Okay, perfect. Perfect. Thanks. Bye.
Oh. He's still there. Oh.
I feel when I call, it's just a race to get off the line.
We just cost him a sale, I'm sure.
I'm with a customer. I kind of feel bad. But wait, when did I call? I called him what?
Called him on Halloween.
I called him on Halloween, Thursday night at like 7:30 p.m.
Yeah.
Like, I'm with a... I think that's bullshit. There's no way.
I don't know. I really don't know. I don't know.
That's such a...
I don't even know what he does.
I don't know either. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
We'll find out at some point. Well, there you go. A happy birthday to Gordon, who turned 30 on Monday.
Yeah.
Let's get out of here with some music. What do I want to listen to get out of here?
I have a suggestion.
Oh, let's do it. Let's do it.
Well, I don't know how many shows we're going to do of this Ludwig Borga, but I don't know if you knew, John. This man was not only a wrestler.
He did many things in the world of entertainment.
He was also a politician, of course, in Finland. Also an MMA fighter who fought for the UFC.
Very controversial politician as well.
Yeah, and also fought for the UFC against Randy Couture.
For Randy Couture's very first fight.
He authored something like 5 books.
Plus, what else?
A techno pop rock musician.
Of course. Mandatory to become a politician.
Yeah, he released an album in 2001 called Mestarit Salila, and this was the first single from the album, Vikingi, the Viking.
Oh, let's go out with the Viking. Ludwig Borga, Tony Holm.
Yeah.
To take us out, we will chat with you later on this week.
Polttoaineena on raaka testosteroni. Exit oli tatuoitu peräpeilini. Kaivaaka jo esiin ensi apuu kittiä. Minä olen bull ja kaikki muut on shittiä. Sillä minä olen viikinki, rautavuori, viikinki. Rautakuori, maine kauan kaltautuu. Se, että ihmismieli antautuu. Minä olen viikinki, jättiläinen viikinki. Äärimmäinen, aina miehen vertainen. Ja tiedän, että oon mä ässä ainut kertainen. Mä aukoa se ole, ei okei. Kehässä on säännöt, mutta kapakassa ei. Tosi mies ei epäröi, se säälimättä lyö. Tosi mies ei sanojaan tai salattia työ. Sillä minä olen viikinki, rautahuori.